Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
And yes, Harvard professor Lawrence Lessig is my next guest. He's been a colleague of Elena Kagan's for years, and appearing on Democracy Now! On Pacifica recently, Lessig laid out one of the big reasons for his support for Kagan for the Supreme Court.
What's most important, in my view, about what the president has done here is he's appointed a non-judge, or he's nominated a non-judge to the Supreme Court. And that's extremely valuable. This court is filled with former judges. And if there had been a non-judge, if there had been Justice O'Connor, who had been a politician before, or even a Justice Rehnquist, this court would not have made its blunder in Citizens United because it would have had a broader perspective and understanding about the political system.
So joining us now to fill in a few more boxes on Elena Kagan's blank slate, as well as to talk about a few other things, is Professor Lawrence Lessig, director of the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard University. He's also co-founder of Change Congress, which is an effort to reform the way money and politics interact. And he's also what some people call an internet guru for the open internet advocacy that he has also done, and we'll talk about some news related to that too. So, Professor Lessig, always nice to have you on WNYC. Welcome back.
Great to be back.
And you've described yourself as a friend and colleague of Elena Kagan's. How well do you know her?
Well, we both began our teaching career at exactly the same time and one office apart at the University of Chicago in 1991. So in those first 4 years before she went to the Clinton White House, we were extremely close. We went to the opera together. We went to dinner together. We learned how to teach together. We conspired about how to make the law school even better law school together. So I feel like I know her very well.
And one of the criticisms of her or of the president appointing someone with her background is that her lack of a written record makes it hard for people to discern where she actually is on the issues. But you've defended that as a function of her jobs to date rather than a lifelong penchant to hide.
Yeah, I think it's really a misframing of this issue to sort of to say that this is somebody who has been hiding her positions, or somebody who is, quote, blank slate, as other people have referred to her. You know, whenever you've got an appointee who is not a judge or not a judge with a long record, remember we had judges like Justice Thomas, who had been on the D.C. Circuit for less than a year before he was appointed to the Supreme Court, and the same with Chief Justice Roberts. He had been a judge for a very short time before he was appointed to the Supreme Court. But when you ordinarily have a judge, you'll have lots of opinions, lots of things to look at. But when you appoint somebody who's not a judge, it's quite often the case that that person is not going to have an extensive written record about their views about every single matter that there is out there. I mean, think about, you know, a 20-year younger David Boies, who's one of the most extraordinary lawyers in American history. If you had tried to appoint somebody like that to the Supreme Court, you'd know practically nothing about his own views about many issues. You'd know what he did as a lawyer, but not what his own views would be. But to take that as a disqualifying characteristic would be to radically narrow the diversity of judges that we could have on the Supreme Court, and I think that would be a big mistake.
So do you want to tell us anything about her views? I mean, you're very, you know, focused on your views, certainly on campaign finance reform, against the Citizens United decision, for example, and she apparently has speech on both sides of that issue. As Solicitor General, she argued against the corporate position for President Obama, but in her private writings, or her non-lawyer writings, she has been seen as taking what might be construed as the Scalia side, equating campaign spending with speech.
Well, first let's make clear, you know, again, contrary to the view that she's a blank slate, we actually have a large range of issues that the Supreme Court regularly considers that she's written extensively about. The First Amendment is one such area. Equal protection is another. Her views about the executive branch, administrative law, is a third. And labor law, she taught labor law as well, is a fourth. That range covers a significant chunk of what the court does. In respect to Citizens United, she argued the case, of course, saying that the statute was constitutional. And what I thought was interesting about that argument is that they advanced what I think was absolutely a correct conception of exactly why this sort of legislation was appropriate. And the reason was that the fear that people rightly have about large campaign contributions in the middle of a campaign is that it makes people believe that Congress is basically corrupt. It's been bought by special interests, which, of course, the vast majority of Americans do believe. And so legislation designed to minimize that appearance of corruption is completely appropriate, as she argued in her case as a Solicitor General. Now, it's true that in her First Amendment writing, she had pointed to the weakness in opinions that suggested that the Congress had a right to balance or to neutralize interests by banning speech. And that was the ground for one of the precedents that the Supreme Court overturned in Citizens United. But I don't take that as a signal that she supports the idea that corporations should have an unlimited right to speak. In fact, what she did as a Solicitor General is advance a novel, I think correct, much more powerful ground on which to understand why that type of extensive speech is inconsistent with the traditions of producing a deliberative democracy that could actually figure out the right answer in a way that we could then trust the government in what it does.
Lawrence Lessig, Harvard professor, my guest on WNYC. As you're hearing, he has known Elena Kagan. He's also worked in his campaign finance reform advocacy against things like the Citizens United Supreme Court ruling, and he's been a founder of the Creative Commons open internet idea, and we'll get to some things related to that too. But in the Creative Commons, you know, you're such an advocate for free speech, for even being able to kind of borrow other people's materials and reinspect what copyright law means and reinvent it for the modern age. But the people on the other side of Citizens United say this is really about free speech, that a corporation or a union or others who united to fight the original law say, look, if we can raise the money to affect campaigns, that's exactly what you do in a democracy. And you don't want the government, you don't want an incumbent protection plan here by the government telling people opposed to them how much money they can spend to voice their arguments against them in elections. Why don't you buy that?
Yeah, so this is why the Citizens United case is actually harder than it's typically described. I'm not somebody who thinks that the court was completely wrong to recognize the importance of free speech interests that corporations should have to express their views about a wide range of public policy issues. I think, you know, we should have a First Amendment that encourages corporations and citizens and non-citizens and dolphins, if dolphins learn how to speak freely, right? So it's not like it's a good thing to silence anybody in the political debate. But that's why Elena's argument in Citizens United, I thought, was so precise and so valuable, because it wasn't that it wasn't about whether corporations should be silenced or not. It was simply to make sure that the way in which they participate in the political debate doesn't produce the impression or understanding or expectation in ordinary people that the system is just corrupt. So it's a distinct issue from whether a company should be allowed to speak. It's whether a company should be able to dominate a political election cycle so that people believe that money has bought results. And that, of course, is the core problem that we face in American politics right now. The vast majority, maybe 88% to 90-some percent in some districts of people believe that money buys results in Congress. It's impossible to look at the sort of stuff you were just talking about in the financial services sector without believing that money had an enormous influence in blocking pretty substantial reform there and also in healthcare. And so finding a way to solve that problem is critical. And I don't think you need to solve that problem. You need to silence speech in order to solve that problem. You just have to have a more targeted regulation, which I think Elena was articulating the grounds on which such a regulation could be upheld.
In our remaining... Oh, by the way, did you hear this article about this article yesterday? Probably means nothing at all, but somehow it's making the rounds in the press, and then, you know, the talk media pick it up, that in her first year at Harvard Law, Elena Kagan earned a B- in torts. Now, she went on to receive much higher grades. But I don't know. Maybe it's good for a constitution, for somebody who's going to go into constitutional law, to not be the most adept at torts.
Yeah, so Elena famously had a bad first term, and she was convinced she had made a terrible mistake by coming to law school. But when she was a first-year teacher, I can report that her first term, she was convinced she had done a terrible job teaching, and she constantly came into my office worried that she was a terrible, terrible teacher. Of course, it turned out she was the best teacher at the University of Chicago Law School, way better than I was. But I think this is a measure of her own humility and sense of place rather than the fact that she's not a strong lawyer or a strong teacher.
I want to spend our remaining few minutes on a couple of online things, since that's, you know, part of what you have done also. A few different writers and thinkers have been pointing to the changes in the Facebook privacy policy in almost apocalyptic terms as a precursor to a fundamental shift in the free internet. How important do you think this is?
Well, I think the events around Facebook are more important to Facebook's brand and loyalty than it is to the internet in general. I mean, I think people have for a long time talked about the fear about privacy on the internet in general, and I think that continues. But what's striking about the Facebook example is just the clumsiness that the company has displayed in understanding the sensitivity that these issues would raise. I mean, they're so eager to find ways to translate their enormous collection of users into profit, that they've not been sufficiently sensitive to the way in which that might, in fact, lead to people abandoning Facebook and adopting other services that are much more privacy protective. So I think this is more a story about Facebook than it is about the internet in general. I think we've got enough to worry about in the internet in general without pointing to Facebook.
What in particular do you think that a Justice Kagan or whoever's on the next court is going to play a role in deciding the future of the internet in any way that's that has broad ramifications?
You know, it's much more important to try to figure out how we can get a Congress that can think seriously and sensibly about the future of the internet than the Supreme Court. It's Congress that's the first line of policy. And it's Congress that's been so abysmal at formulating policies that can actually protect the internet against obvious threats. I mean, you know, the Congress has passed scores, literally, of bills trying to deal with copyright problems on the internet. And I'm a supporter of copyright, but I think they've been overly obsessed with that. They've passed one bill, precisely one bill, to deal with spam, which, of course, is not just a nuisance. It begins to be the pathway through which payloads of extraordinarily dangerous technology get spread across computers around the world. So I think that, you know, the core problem here is not to worry about the Supreme Court's review of laws. It's to imagine a Congress that could actually get it right in the first place.
So what do you think is most important, in your opinion, for Congress to do? Is it net neutrality, which, as more people hear about that, hear about the concept, you know, it's easy on the one hand to say, well, of course, there should be network neutrality on the internet. An internet service provider shouldn't be able to give WNYC to users at a slower speed than it gives a, you know, Fox News Channel site, because Fox can pay more than we can. I mean, that's sort of a classic example, is who can buy their way to faster speeds and marginalize everyone else. Another aspect of that, though, is that companies or services that use things that take up tremendous amount of bandwidth can clog it up for everybody else unless there isn't net neutrality, unless they can actually charge more for those services. So is it a complex mix of right and wrong?
The issue of network neutrality is complex, and I don't think it's a violation of network neutrality that you pay more for taking more. You know, just like it's you pay more for if you lose more electricity, that's not a violation of any neutrality rule. It's just to make sure that when you plug in a Sony television set, it doesn't work worse than a Panasonic television set, right? That's the core concept of network neutrality. But network neutrality is just one issue in a suite of issues about how to guarantee that we actually have a broadband system to be proud of. I mean, this is the most important fact to keep in mind. The United States has had a radical decline relative to other countries around the world in broadband performance. Right now in France, for $33 a month, you can get 20 megabits per second service on the internet, plus HDTV, plus free telephone all across France and free international calling to 70 countries across the world, plus in a whole bunch of Wi-Fi hotspots, free access to Wi-Fi at $33 a month. There is no place in the United States right now that comes anywhere close to that level of service.
We just have 20 seconds left. Is that something you want Congress to mandate?
I want Congress to deal with policies that can bring about the kind of competition that other countries in the world have right now. And Congress hasn't done that so far. And that's the more important broadband question than network neutrality.
Lawrence Lessig is the director of the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard University and co-founder of the group Change Congress. Thank you so much.
Great to be on.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us. More to come.